On the fourth day of what should have been a simple trial, Fleabait spent the entire morning interrogating the other two members of the original Morris and Hooker hunting quartet. The oil man who had transferred his affections to Scotland, and the dentist who loved dogs. And rarely did he have two witnesses who supported a case more handsomely. Each man, in his own way, proved that he was a dedicated sportsman, and each disclosed secrets of Todd Morrison's behavior, which proved that he had never been. He was not a true sportsman, the oil man said, with a decided English accent. He never gave the game a fair chance. "You mean he would fire at a quail sitting on the ground?" Fleabait asked in horror. As soon as the oil man replied, "He would," the county prosecutor leaped up. "Objection! Distinguished defense counsel is leading the witness." Objection sustained. The jury will ignore that last reply. Fleabait stood apart, as if detached from the proceedings, and shook his head as if in pain. At the same time, he muttered to himself, but loud enough to be heard throughout the courtroom, "Shot a sittin' bird. I can't believe it." He then sighed, returned to the trial, and asked the oil man, "And he shot a doe out of season, with no license to shoot one even in season?" Again the charade was repeated. Objection sustained, and Fleabait brooding aloud, "A doe out of season. I can't believe it." And then, patiently, "Did Mr. Hooker, the man you call Roy Bubb, did he ever do such things?" "Oh, no. Roy Bubb taught us all what sportsmanship was." "Now, as to the financial arrangements covering your lease at Falfurrias, I understand that when you pulled out, some rather harsh words were spoken." "I believe that was the dentist, about his dogs." "Yes. Yes, very harsh words, indeed. We'll get to that. But in your case, it dealt with money matters, did it not?" And in this patient way, the sleazy shifts and dodges of Morrison's operations were unraveled. The dentist was an admirable witness. "You say you never fired a gun at the Falfurrias lease. What in the world did you do?" "I trained my dogs." "You brought your dogs along so that the other three could profit from their skill, which I am told was extraordinary." "Yes." "You surrendered all your free time so that others could enjoy the hunt? I call that true sportsmanship." "Was Todd Morrison a sportsman?" "Didn't know the meaning of the word." "When you quit the foursome, I believe you had words with Morrison about his financial dealings." District Attorney Welton objected to this line of questioning, charging that, without any kind of substantiation, it was mere hearsay, but the judge overruled the objection. "In my dealings with Morrison, he invariably tried to chisel me. He was not a likable man." "But you were his partner, so to say, in the lease, I mean." "At first I thought he had no money, so I sort of carried him. Later I discovered that he had more than I did. He was not a pleasant person." On the fifth day, Fleabait practically destroyed Todd Morrison, proving much, intimating more, and then, after a dramatic pause, thrusting both hands under his armpits and scratching. The jury, having been alerted to watch out for this, smiled knowingly. Now, you and I know that people from Michigan do not adhere to the same high moral principles that govern behavior in Texas. They can be fine people by their own lights, and they can get along fairly well in the more relaxed moral climate of Detroit and Pontiac. But when they move to Texas, as so many do, they find themselves confronted by a much stricter moral code. Here, a man is supposed to behave like a man. A sportsman has certain clearly defined patterns of acceptable behavior, which the newcomer from Michigan has a difficult time honoring. I have nothing against Michigan. I'm sure there are fine people in Michigan, many of them. But when they come into Texas, they are held to a nobler code of behavior, and to tell you the truth, many of them fail to meet the mark. They are not ready for Texas. They are not prepared to face our more demanding standards. Todd Morrison was such a man. I do not want you to judge him harshly, because he knew no better. He had not been raised with the clean wind of the prairie, blowing away the cobwebs that entangle human beings. He never rode a horse across the plains. He was not trained in the harsh lessons of honor and trust and sportsmanship. I do not want you to condemn this poor dead man who lost his way in a new and more exacting land. I want you to forgive him. Here he scratched again. And I want you to understand why an honest, God-fearing Texan, born in the heart of good sportsmanship, felt that he had to shoot him. You surely know by now that Todd Morrison, this pathetic stranger who never fitted in, who could not obey our strict code of honor, deserved to die. The foreman of the jury asked the judge if it was obligatory for them to leave the jury box before handing in their verdict, and he said it would look better. So they marched out and marched right back in. During Sherwood Cobb's first 2 years as a member of the Water Commission, he could make no headway in his campaign for a sensible water plan for Texas. But now two natural disasters struck, which awakened the state to the fact that it lived in peril, like all other areas of the world, where, though the perils might be different, all stemmed from the inherent limitations imposed by nature. Drought hit some portion of Texas about every 10 years, but the state was so large that other areas did not suffer. However, about once each quarter of a century, great portions of the state were hit at the same time. Farms were wiped out, ranches were decimated, and land gamblers were reminded that there were definite limits beyond which they dare not go. In 1932, the great drought had struck in Oklahoma, reaching Texas in 1933, and converting large areas of both states into dust bowls. And 1950 had delivered a savage drought, which lasted 7 years. Now another crushing dry spell gripped the western half of the state. Water holes went dry. Rivers that were supposed to be perpetual failed. And even a supposedly safe coastal city like Corpus Christi was forced to institute water rationing. Now, when Cobb moved about the state, seeking to generate support for his plans, people listened. And he told his wife, "I used to say we'd have no serious approach to our water problems till the year 2010. A few more years of this drought, and you can advance that to about 1995. But I want to see it happen in 1985. He went to all parts of Texas, pleading with farmers, ranchers, and businessmen to devise a water system for their state. But in addition to talking, he acted, sometimes 20 hours a day, to rescue ranchers who were about to lose their cattle. He arranged for grasslands in the unaffected eastern half to truck in cattle from the arid areas and water them without cost till the emergency waned. He organized auctions at which ranchers with no water at all could sell their animals to buyers from other states whose fields did have water. For as one rancher who had to sell at distress said, "I'd rather see my cattle live and make a profit for someone else than stand here and watch them perish." And Cobb persuaded other Texas cattlemen to adopt the same attitude. In short, Sherwood Cobb acted in this emergency the way his ancestor Senator Somerset Cobb had responded to the disasters of the Civil War and Reconstruction, and as another ancestor, Senator Laurel Cobb, had acted when great changes were underway in the 1920s. He rolled up his sleeves and went to work. Like Ransom Rusk, gritting his teeth and bearing his enormous financial setbacks, Cobb accepted the challenge of the natural ones. But in the midst of his constructive work, Texas was struck with a final assault of such magnitude that even Cobb reeled. Folk legend said that once every 100 years, snow fell in Brownsville, the southernmost city in Texas, and a land of palm trees and bougainvillea. On Christmas Day in 1983, the thermometer along the Rio Grande dropped far, far below freezing, and the results were staggering. When Cobb arrived 2 days after Christmas on emergency assignment from the Department of Agriculture, he found entire grapefruit orchards wiped out by the excessive cold. Avocado trees were no more. Orange groves were obviously destroyed. And the famous palm trees of Corpus Christi and other southern towns were dead in the bitter winds. Hundreds of millions of dollars were lost in this one terrible freeze, so that communities who had watched their stores close because of the fall of the peso now saw their agriculture destroyed by a fall in the thermometer. The valley, staggered before, now lay desolated. Cobb found in the distraught area one local leader who seemed to have as firm a grasp of reality as he, Cobb, had. It was Mayor Simon Garza of Bravo, who toured the valley ceaselessly, organizing relief operations. And as the two men worked together, Cobb 10 years the older, they formed a pact that would endure through the years ahead. "Garza, you make more sense than anyone else I've met. People live on the land, the rancher out west, the citrus grower down here, the farmer up the coast. We're restricted by what the land will allow us to do, and when we forget that, we're in trouble." Garza said, "I read an editorial the other day. It said, 'God has gone out of his way to remind us that even Texans are mortal. These are devastating years, but we can build upon them.'" And the two men, optimists, as all Texans are required by law to be, went quietly ahead with their plans, however fragmentary, to save the citrus industry in the valley, ranching on the high plains, and water supplies everywhere. But Cobb, like his valiant ancestors, and like his Aunt Lorena up in Waxahachie, was an ebullient man, and as he toured his state, proud of its ability to fight back, he savored the many hilarious behaviors that made Texas different from any other state he knew. And as he witnessed these crazy things, he jotted down brief notes, which he mailed back to his wife so that she too could laugh. In Jefferson, I attended in the schoolhouse a lecture entitled "The Heritage of Robert E. Lee." And at the end, the chairlady said, voice throbbing with emotion, "Now, if we will all stand, please." And with her hand over her heart, she led the singing. "I wish I was in the land of cotton, old times dar am not forgotten." Fervently, we sang of a glory none of us had ever known, but whose legends were etched on our hearts. And when we reached that marvelous chorus, one of the most powerful ever written, I was shouting with the others, "In Dixieland I'll take my stand, to lib and die in Dixie. Away, away, away down south in Dixie." When the song ended, with some of us wiping our eyes, I said to the man next to me, "If a bugle sounded now, half this crowd would march north." And he said, "Yep, and this time we'd whop 'em." You and I have often talked about what our favorite town in Texas was. North Zulch always stood high. Oatmeal was good. You liked Mule Shoe. The other day I drove through my favorite, Megargel, population 381, with a sign that says, "Watch Us Grow." As I drove through, I saw a pickup with the bumper sticker, "Support Jesus and your local sheriff." Carry on, Megargel. At Larkin, where they have that famous statue you wouldn't let me photograph, I saw something I hadn't noticed before. On the courthouse lawn were two bold bronze plaques, one proclaiming that for 3 glorious years during the 1920s, the Larkin Fighting Antelopes had been state champions in football. The other, that one night in 1881, the notorious one-armed gunman Amos Peavine had slept in Larkin prior to his gunning down of Daniel Parmentier, respected lawyer of the place. And as I studied the two memorials, I had to reflect upon the mores of the small Texas towns. I'm sure Larkin must have produced dedicated women who taught their students with love and constructive influence. It surely had bright boys who went on to become state and national leaders. It must have had brave judges who tamed the Western Range and men who built fortunes which they spent wisely. And there must have been citizens of no wide repute who held the town together, perhaps a barber or a seamstress on whom the weak depended. I can think of 100 citizens of Larkin that I would like to memorialize. But what do? We erect monuments to a murderous gunman who slept here one night, and to a football team whose coach and most of whose players came from somewhere else. Just once, I would like to drive into a Texas town and see a bronze plaque to a man who wrote a poem or to a woman who composed a lasting song. Returning from the session on catchment dams, I had the radio on and heard the song I'm going to recommend as the official state song of Texas, because it honors the two noblest aspects of our culture, football and religion. Dropkick Me Jesus Through the Goalposts of Life. I grow mournful when I hold a water meeting in some little town that used to flourish but is now dying. There must be hundreds of such places, doomed to disappear before the end of the century, and I've constructed Cobb's Law to cover the situation. If a town has less than 400 population and stands within 20 miles of a big shopping center, it's got to vanish. The automobile determines that, and there's not a damned thing we can do about it. Texas, always dying, always arising in some new location with some new mission. I love the redneck songs of Texas, San Antonio Rose, El Paso, and the new one I've memorized so I can sing it to you when we're traveling. Blue flies lazin' in the noonday sun, dogies grazin' at their rest, old steers drinkin' at the salty run, this is Texas at its best. Sleep on, Jim, I'll watch the herd. Doze on, Slim, fly northward, bird. All the range is peaceful. He had a chance to sing this ballad to his wife when she accompanied him to two water meetings held by chance in two of the truly bizarre places in Texas. The first was the schoolhouse in the little oil town of Sundown, southwest of Levelland. The feisty town fathers, discovering that the oil companies would have to pay for whatever the board legally decided, opted to have the finest school in America. So, for a total school enrollment of only 140 pupils, they built a $7 million Taj Mahal, featuring a gymnasium fit for the Boston Celtics, an auditorium finer than most New York theaters, and an Olympic-sized swimming pool under glass. What staggers me, Cobb told his wife, is that in the pool they teach canoeing. Yep, look at those two aluminum canoes, and there isn't any water within miles. When I asked about this, a member of the school board said, "Well, some of our kids may emigrate to Maine, where canoeing is real big." Mrs. Cobb preferred the miniature condominium built into the center of the school. "What's it for?" And an official explained, "We want to teach our home ec girls how to make beds." The superintendent's office was special. Directly under it, at a depth of thousands of feet, rested an oil well, drilled at an angle. "It's how we get our petty cash," an official said. But what gave the Cobbs renewed hope for Texas every time they saw it was an amazing structure in the roughneck oil town of Odessa, where the oil rigs Rusk had been unable to sell, even at a heavy loss, rusted in the sun. There, years ago, a young woman schoolteacher, without a cent, had fallen in love with William Shakespeare. Driven by a vision that never faltered, she had begged and borrowed and scrounged until she had accumulated enough money to build an accurate replica of Shakespeare's Globe Theater. There it stood in the sandy desert, full scale, and to it came Shakespearean actors from many different theaters and countries to orate the soaring lines of the master. "We don't do many of his historical plays," the director told Cobb. "Our customers prefer the love stories and the gory tragedies." "I'll be sending you a check one of these days," Mrs. Cobb said. For the Globe was kept alive by families like the Cobbs, who felt that Shakespeare added a touch of grace to the drylands. As Cobb left the meeting, at which, speaking from the Shakespearean stage, he had pleaded for water legislation, he stopped and looked back at this preposterous building. "I love the craziness of Texas. It's still the biggest state in the Union, without Eskimos." Maggie Morrison had been shocked by the murder of her husband, not by the fact that his shady behavior had resulted in the shooting, for she had anticipated something like this, but by the fact that it was Roy Bubb who had done it. She knew him to be a man of intense integrity, and for him to have pulled the trigger added extra pain. After the verdict was returned, a proper one, she thought, she learned that she stood to inherit all of Ollerkamp, a fair portion of which morally belonged to Roy Bubb. With the honesty which characterized her, she flew to Dallas to consult with Rusk. "I cannot keep Ollerkamp. Much of it is Roy Bubb's. But I can't offer him an adjustment, because it would look as if we had conspired to have my husband eliminated. Allow the will to be probated. Take Ollerkamp and keep your mouth shut. To do that would strangle me. Maggie, I wasn't going to tell you this, but I've taken care of Roy Bubb, what we call a finder's fee." "What did he find?" "Ollerkamp. Before Todd died, the scoundrel was preparing to sell me Ollerkamp. He was going to quit the exotic business." "What about Roy Bubb?" "Your husband never gave a damn about him." "I'm not surprised. Houston ruined Todd. When we first came down, we held family meetings. Kids, Maggie, we're going into this deal, and we could lose our shirts. We shared everything. Then, when he began to shave corners, we knew only the honest parts. Finally, we knew nothing. Your husband and I agreed on a fair price for the place. I'll show you the papers. His lawyer, mine, will confirm their authenticity. You should allow the deal to go through." "What will it mean to me?" $4 million. The deal did go through, and on the day it was settled, Maggie initiated three moves which symbolized her changed attitudes. She drove out to Ollerkamp to inspect the manner in which Roy Bubb Hooker had laid out the seven main areas that would make it one of the best exotic ranches in Texas. And when Rusk explained how it would be used, she told the partners, "You're putting the place to good use. May it succeed beyond your dreams." The second thing of importance she did was surrender the family's fancy condominium along Buffalo Bayou. As she confided to her children, "I feel uneasy sitting here and looking across the way at those three towers of the ramparts, thinking how I bought them at distress from the Mexicans and sold them to the Canadians 3 weeks before the hurricane. It haunts me. Seems immoral." She moved instead to a beautiful, dignified condominium well west of the center of town, the St. James, where she bought one of the smaller units on the 23rd floor for $538,000 and spent another $92,000 decorating it. There, overlooking a park, she did the brainwork for her real estate business, driving to her office early each morning. When real estate acquaintances in other cities called to ask, "Did Hurricane Alicia destroy values in Houston?" she felt so defensive about her city that she drafted a thoughtful form letter. "I know you saw the horrendous scenes on television, our beautiful buildings with their windows knocked out like old women with no front teeth. I assure you, with my hand on the Bible, that only a few buildings were so hit, and not one of them suffered any structural damage. Houston has snapped back stronger than before. I am buying and selling as if there had never been a hurricane, for I know that if we survived Alicia, we can survive anything. If you crave action, come aboard." But it was her third change that represented the most significant modification, because when she moved to the St. James, she found herself conveniently close to Highway 610, that magic loop which encircled the central Houston she loved. Now, two or three nights a week after dinner, when the intolerable traffic abated, she went down to her garage, climbed into her Mercedes, and drove thoughtfully eastward till she hit a ramp leading to 610. There, she weaved her way onto the striking thoroughfare, one of the busiest in America, and started the 38-mile circuit of the city, ticking off her position on an imaginary clock. Where she entered was 9 o'clock, due west. Up where the airport waited, with its enormous flow of plane and auto traffic, was 12. 3 o'clock on the extreme east carried her into the smoke-filled, bustling commercial district that huddled about the Houston Ship Channel, with its hundreds of plants affiliated with the oil industry. This area interested her immensely, for in it she saw many prospects for growth. 6 o'clock was due south, where the immense medical center and the handsome Astrodome predominated. And at the end of 50 minutes, she was back at Westheimer, taking a last look at the city she had grown to love. What a glorious town! Spires everywhere glinting in the moonlight. God smiled at me when he brought me here, to help build and sell those splendid buildings. 2 nights a week, sometimes 3, she made this circuit of her city, checking upon current building, predicting its future growth. Sometimes male dinner companions accompanied her. "Maggie, you mustn't do this alone. 610 is a jungle, worst highway in America. You know that during rush hour the police won't even enter it to check on ordinary fender benders. They got beat up too often by enraged motorists, sometimes shot and killed. But I stay clear during rush hours. And for God's sake, don't drive with your window down. This is my town. I love it, and I want to check on it." One night as she was driving, with her eye to lands outside the circle, a full moon eliminated a section of the city she had never before studied seriously. It stood at 10 o'clock, to the northwest, and it comprised about 15 blocks of housing which could be torn down at no great loss. And she eased into an outer lane so that she could slow down and inspect the place. With imaginary bulldozers and wrecking balls, she leveled the houses, then erected a pair of soaring towers with all attendant shopping areas. 48 floors to each tower, right? 6 condominiums per floor? But save the first 4 levels for office space. We could get 500 units easily, plus 6 gorgeous penthouses at $3,500,000 each. Futura, she dubbed her imaginary towers. And now, when she circled the city at night, she waited breathlessly for the approach of Futura, analyzing it from all angles. In the daytime, after work, she drove through the area and found that 17 blocks would provide the necessary land area. Then she began to consult secretly with Gabe Klinowitz as to prices in the district. And with his figures in her head, she started sketching plans for a major development. When she costed them, as the phrase in her industry went, she found that for $210 million, she could probably acquire the land, raise the buildings on it, and erect her twin-towered masterpiece. As soon as she had a working budget in mind, she realized that there was only one source available to her for such a vast amount, so she flew to Dallas and placed her design before Ransom Rusk, who was recovering nicely from the shocks of the preceding years when he saw his net worth drop by nearly $500 million. He was deeply engaged in the election, sweating over whether or not Reagan would be re-elected. So many damn blacks and Mexicans registering, a man can't make predictions. He was also contributing vast sums toward the defeat of 8 or 9 Democratic senators around the country, because he felt, as he told Maggie, "This is one of the crucial elections of our national history. If Reagan's coattails are long enough, we'll even regain control of the House, and then we can turn this sloppy nation around permanently." Reagan, a great patriot in the White House. His nominees filling the Supreme Court. A Republican Congress. And will start taking over the state houses. With each potential triumph, he became more excited. "Maggie, we can put some backbone into this nation. Clean up things in Central America. End the disgrace of public welfare. And see America tall in the saddle again. We'll wipe out the stain of Franklin Roosevelt once and for all." As a lifelong Democrat, whose parents had come from the working class, she was amused when Rusk fulminated in this way, and did not take him seriously. But gradually he said things which astonished her. "It's criminal for the Democrats to go around making Mexicans register when they understand none of the issues. The vote should be reserved for the people who own the nation and pay the taxes." "Do you mean that?" she had asked. and his thoughtful reply surprised her. I calculated the other day that my efforts ensure the employment of nearly 4,000 people. Counting four to a family, that's 16,000 citizens I support. Am I to be outvoted by two unemployed Mexican hangers-on who can't read English? When she pursued the matter, he confessed, Yes, I'd like to see a means test for the vote. Only people who have a real stake in society can know what's best for that society. She was not yet ready to accept this new philosophy which was sweeping the nation. But in August, when Rusk invited her to join him at the Republican National Convention in Dallas, she had an opportunity to observe him as he moved among people of his own kind. And she was impressed to find that he knew all the leaders and was welcomed in the suites of both President Reagan, delightful man, and Vice President Bush, a reassuring fellow Texan from Midland. She noticed that Rusk was warmly greeted by the famous clergyman who had swarmed into Dallas to prove that God was a Republican and America a Christian nation. It was an exciting week, and once, when she sat in a privileged seat, she felt a surge of pride as she looked down upon the delegates, that endless parade of fine, clean-cut people from all parts of the nation. The bankers, the managers, the store owners, the elderly women with blue-tinted hair. And not too often, a black or a Hispanic to confuse the pattern. It was at this euphoric moment that Maggie first began to consider seriously her partner's philosophy that the men who own the nation ought to govern it. The idea was crudely expressed, and she knew that if the newspapers got hold of it, they would make sport of Rusk. But it did summarize a fundamental truth about America, and it was worth further study. On the morning after the convention ended on a note of high triumph, Maggie placed before Rusk the plans for her master development, and was distressed when he seemed to back off, as if the project was too big for him to finance at this time. "Ransom, are you turning me down?" "No, but I am turning down Houston. Now is not the time to start new building in that town." She gasped, then said defensively, "I love Houston. It gave me life, maturity, even happiness of a sort." "Time to be realistic. New buildings are standing empty." "But Ransom, I've been mailing brochures assuring real estate customers that Houston is not finished." She hesitated, looked pleadingly, saw the obdurate scowl, and asked softly, "Are you suggesting Dallas?" "I haven't mentioned Dallas. It's overbuilt, too." "What do you have in mind?" "Austin." She had never contemplated shifting her operations from a city with more than 2 million to one about one-fifth that size, but Rusk was adamant. "Houston 20 years ago is Austin today." "Can it absorb something like Futura?" He avoided a direct answer. "That's a dreadful name. Sounds like a bath soap." "What would you propose?" "Something classy, English, like the Bristol or Warwick Towers, but they've been overdone." Then he snapped his fingers. "I have it, the Nottingham. Our logo? Robin Hood, in outline, wearing that crazy peaked hat. We'll make it the most fashionable address in Texas." Maggie, trying not to smile at the picture of Ransom Rusk offering himself as a Robin Hood, stealing from the poor to aid the rich, kept her mind on the main problem. "Where do we get the 200 million?" Without hesitation, he replied, "West Germany, or the Arabs. They're itching to invest in Texas." And while she waited, he called his bankers in Frankfurt and asked, "Carl Philip, do your boys still have those funds you talked about last month?" "Good. I'm putting you down for 210 million. There was a pause, which Maggie interpreted as shock on the other end. But it was not. "No, not Houston. It's marking time at present. And not Dallas, either. It's overbuilt. Austin. Another pause. State capital. America's new Silicon Valley. Our fastest-growing city. Hotter than an oil boom town. When he hung up, he gave Maggie a simple directive. Fly right down to Austin, locate the perfect spot, and get someone to buy the real estate in secret. With the design for her two luxury towers firmly in mind, she rode to the airport in Rusk's car, which delivered her to the door of the Rusk plane. In less than 40 minutes, she was landing at the Austin airport, and the next 4 days were hectic. In a rented car, she explored the unfamiliar beauties of this lovely little city, and by noon she had counted a dozen giant cranes busy at the job of erecting very tall buildings. "My God," she cried, "this really is the new Houston." And that afternoon she chanced on a young man, Paul Sampson, recently down from Indianapolis, who could have been Todd Morrison in 1969. He had the same brash approach, the same nervous eagerness, the same indication that he was going to be adroit in arranging deals. He worked for a large real estate firm, but gave every promise of owning the outfit within 2 years, and by nightfall he had shown Maggie 16 sites which could accommodate new buildings. That night she called Rusk. "Ransom, real estate is so hot down here that the place simply has to go bust." Very quietly he assured her, "Of course it'll go bust. Everything does, sooner or later. Our job is to get in fast and out first." "Then you want me to go ahead?" "With German money, how can we go wrong?" So early next morning she was at Paul Sampson's office, with the kind of proposition cagey operators had brought her husband in the early 1970s. "Could you quietly assemble about 6 city blocks for me, Standard Commission?" "I can do anything you require, madam," he said, and she could see that his palms were sweating. "Where do you want them? In the heart of the city?" "Show me the possibilities." And when he kept stressing an area which she distrusted, she said, "You own a parcel in there, don't you?" And he protested, "Look, madam, if you don't trust me, we can't do business." And she said, "If you try to sell me that junk you're stuck with, we'll never do business." Startled by her shrewd understanding, he stopped trying to peddle his third-rate property and started driving her to the eligible areas. And by the end of the fourth day, she had found something farther out than he had expected her to go. It was a grand area, west of Route 360, and atop a rise which gave a splendid view of both Lake Travis and the famed hill country. "Will people buy this far out?" Sampson asked. And she said, "When they see what we're going to build." And with that, she gave him a commission to acquire 4 parcels of about 10 acres each. And when the agreement was signed, in great secrecy, he said, "Can I ask what you're going to build up there?" And she said, "A hunting range for Robin Hood." When she saw the excitement in his eyes and his eagerness to get started, she thought of her former husband, and she wished the young man good luck. She hoped he would handle himself better than Todd had done, but she had a strong premonition that he was going to go the same way. Because 3 weeks later, after he had delivered the 40 acres to her at a price that was gratifying, she learned that he had mortgaged himself to the hilt in order to buy, for his own account, 2 small choice plots that would dominate any roads into or out of Nottingham. "You'll do well, Sampson," she said, as she ended negotiations. "Stay clean." And he startled her by saying with great assurance, "Mrs. Morrison, you'll bless the day you met me. That land will be worth millions, because this Austin thing can go on forever."